Let me tell you a little bit about what I do. I work for Senator Hatch, as he said. I handle agriculture, energy, environment, public lands, natural resources for the senator. And I've always thought that Senate staff are probably government's best deal. I make a pretty mild salary. I think on Capitol Hill we make 30% less on average than your normal government officials. And the Clean Cities folks can tell you government officials don't make a lot. And so I've always sort of bragged about the fact that, hey, the Senate is probably the most efficient aspect of our government. And then I met the Clean Cities program folks, and I think I've been outbeat. I've always believed in the 80-20 rule, where 20% of the people do 80% of the work. And that's, I think, true with Clean Cities. Clean Cities is important for the obvious reasons. First of all, you're helping to improve the environment. Second of all, you're helping to advance our country's technologies. And these are technologies that affect everything. Transportation touches every aspect of our lives. And our nation needs to be in advance on those issues. And Clean Cities is the only group I know of that's actually putting things on the road from a government perspective, hands-on. Thirdly, Clean Cities is important because it improves our energy security. Energy security is so much more important than just a matter of trying to get that fleet of school buses to start using biodiesel. Energy security is a problem that we are only beginning to fully understand. Let me talk a little bit about what's happening in the world. Right now in Saudi Arabia, well, for the entire history of Saudi Arabia, they have been producing much more oil than anybody else. We all know that. There's nothing new to that. About 90% of their oil comes from four wells, from four big reserves. Think about that. How many wells do we have in the United States? Tens and tens of thousands of wells. They have all of their oil coming out of four wells. They probably have 100 other smaller wells that don't match at all these four wells. These are super giant reserves. Nothing in the world can touch them. The problem is these reserves have been pumping full tilt for 40 years. Think about that. How long does an oil reserve usually last? Well, most people in the energy business are taking one of two sides. There's the people who believe that Saudi Arabia has sort of reached its maximum capacity and is dwindling fast. And there's the other camp who believes Saudi Arabia can continue to do what they've been doing for the last 40 years. It's a very hot debate, and some of our smartest people don't agree on it. But there's a few things we need to recognize. First of all, Saudi Arabia is at full capacity. Very important to recognize that in the history of oil in this world, Saudi Arabia has always been able to step up and increase their capacity to meet global demand. There's actually been one or two times where they've withheld capacity to raise prices to make a point. Sometimes they've been trying to make a point to other OPEC members. Sometimes they're trying to make a point to Richard Nixon. But for the most part, OPEC has always tried to step up and keep oil at a reasonable rate. Saudi Arabia, along with OPEC, has maintained a price band where they keep price not too high because they don't want too much competition, and they also don't want their partners to suffer, but also to keep it so it's not too low so that they can maintain their profits. And it's called a price band that they have created. The idea started in Texas. The Texas Railroad Commission was the first organization to do that. The U.S. was oil king, and they controlled prices to an extent that they created a price band. OPEC discovered, well, the Saudi Arabia's of the world discovered oil. They created a price band. The ability of OPEC to maintain a price band is basically non-existent. Let me show you. I'm going to do some funny things with my arms here, but stay with me for a while. Here is where our oil demand, well, let's say this is where our oil supply is. No, this is our oil demand, okay, in the world. This is global oil demand. This is about where you would see oil supply. So we have a problem. This is a gap that ethanol will never be able to breach. This is a big gap. This is a gap that is a global gap. There is nothing happening that's going to close this gap. Let me give you an example. I'm going to put one more line up here. I wish I had another arm. I'm going to show you what the line looks like when you talk about new discoveries of oil. It looks something like this. Okay? So not only do we have a gap, but we have a gap that's growing, and we don't have an answer that's anywhere near the size of that gap. We're struggling now with $3 a barrel. People get pretty excited when we get to $3 a barrel. I have a feeling we might have to get used to that, that we'll look back on these days and be happy about the fact that one day we only paid $3 a barrel. Right now, there are very good energy experts who say Saudi Arabia has a little bit less than half of the reserves that they are saying publicly that they have. Kuwait, 3 weeks ago, a report came out of Kuwait, within Kuwait, that they have less than half the reserves that they've been putting out there. And it's even started within their own government, some investigations and things like that to find out if this is true. These are government-owned resources. They keep it very, very tight. The fact of the matter is that spare capacity of oil by the OPEC nations does not exist. So this is not your normal business cycle. Always in the past, there was this ability to increase capacity when prices get too high. We're not at that stage anymore, and it could be we really have a whole new situation on our hands. I'm going to give you a couple myths about oil prices. First of all, the high oil prices are not caused because CEOs are getting very high salaries. That is not the cause of it, although we get hearing that a lot in the news. CEOs in oil companies get huge salaries. There's no doubt about it. This one guy with a really huge chin, it's absurd the amount of money he's getting, but is that causing high prices? No, it's not causing high prices. Huge profits by our big oil companies, is that causing the high prices? No. I've always thought that was a fairly weird argument. Here's a company making a product, it becomes fairly scarce, the price goes way up, so their profits go way up. That's basic Econ 101, right? High prices lead to higher profits, and so they're getting filthy rich, so to speak. That doesn't mean that their high profits are causing the high prices. It's sort of a reverse argument. So yes, CEOs are getting overpaid, let's say. Oil companies have huge profits. Those are not the causes of high oil prices. So you need to de-link the causal relationship that people are drawing there. The other argument is that companies are too big. Senator Hatch sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. About a month and a half ago, we had a hearing on the big oil. We called in all the big oil CEOs and said, you guys are merging too much, you're getting too big, you're manipulating the market. I'm just going to tell you that's a myth, okay? They are merging, they are getting bigger. That is not the cause of high prices. We need to remember the facts. The facts are that 77% of the oil in this country is controlled by guess who? Governments. Somebody said the Saudis, and you should be able to speak up if you want. That's a good idea. The Saudis are one of them, Kuwait's some of them. When you throw out, look at our big, huge oil giant, ExxonMobil. We send ExxonMobil out into the global marketplace to compete. And guess what they look like out there? Here's Saudi Arabia. Their oil is owned by their government. They have Aramco, a nationally owned government, nationally owned oil company. You have Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Nigeria. You have Venezuela, now Bolivia. All these are resources owned by the governments. Here's the size of these companies, and here's our little ExxonMobil. They're puny when they get in the global marketplace. Our oil companies have to get strong. They have to get profits. They have to merge. They have to be the strongest and leanest they can possibly be, and also they need to be flush with cash, or they're not going to begin to compete in this market. So I'm not saying they're not making too big profits. I'm not saying CEOs have stupid salaries. I'm saying it's not the cause of high oil prices. I just want to bust that myth for a minute. Our country has 5% of the world's population. Our company consumes 25% of the world's energy. So I guess our country, our government, must spend a lot of time developing oil for our needs. Right? Wrong. Our government leaves it completely up to private industry to meet this gigantic appetite for oil. Our government does not produce one drop of oil. Our government does not produce one pipeline. Our government does not produce one refinery. Our government sometimes stands in the way. Our government sometimes wants to tax the profits of the people who have to build that infrastructure. That's why I think it's important that we bust that myth. We want these companies to focus their profits on our energy future, and that's maybe a good government policy. But just taxing profits from oil companies and then using that money for Medicare or whatever is not going to produce one drop of oil. It's only going to take it away. So I want to focus a little bit on some of the solutions that we should be focusing on. Let me talk for a minute just about... This morning I was up in my hotel room trying to scribble out a couple new notes. I want to talk a little bit about the impacts that this... Remember these lines? Those lines aren't going anywhere good. It's just more pain and more struggle. And I want to talk a little bit more about the impacts that that's going to have on us. First of all, everybody in this room... Raise your hand if you have not refinanced your home in the last 4 or 5 years. Looks like about a fourth of you. Pretty interesting, huh? I didn't. I refinanced, so I didn't raise my hand. Everybody raise your hand who does not directly know somebody who has refinanced their home in the last 4 or 5 years. Okay, not one hand. We need to understand that's very significant to our discussion. We have been through $3 gas prices already. This is not the first time. It wasn't too long ago last year that we had them before. The impacts of high oil prices affect everything. However, our country, 1/4 of our country's GDP has been based on housing. Everybody here knows somebody or has done it themselves, has refinanced their home. And what happens when you refinance your home? You are flush with cash. You are wealthier than you were 2 weeks before by far. When you refinance your home, things are going great. And if energy prices get to $3 for a gallon of gas, you can take it. And the economy can take it because we're still spending in all of the sectors. The way the stock market works, well, this is even before Econ 101. If I have a dollar and I give it to somebody for a knife, well, let's say a home builder. I build a home, it's worth $100,000, which of course it'll be worth more than that, but just for theory. Now somebody gives me $100,000 for my work that I put into that and some of the materials. I walk away with $100,000. That person now has a home that's worth $100,000. We haven't quite doubled, but it's like doubling your money. When we spend money, money doubles. And when it passes around, it builds. You actually have more money the more you spend in a global economy. That's just basic economics. When you withdraw your money and you're not spending it, the economy goes down. Well, that's why, because money is not replicating itself. When oil prices go high, oil company profits are going to go very, very high. But transportation and all the costs of doing business on all the other things in the stock market are going to get harmed. Money's going to withdraw from those areas because money's being spent on oil. So if you're investing in oil, you're going to do great. Everything else in the stock market is going to get hammered. And that's what we're facing. Don't forget, 1/4 of our entire GDP was in housing. The next time this energy crunch hits, we probably will not have gone through a gigantic housing bubble and a gigantic movement to refinance homes. And I think we'll feel the impacts, which we luckily escaped this time around. Let's see. Just want to talk a little bit about it. First of all, when scarce supply goes down, you have a great deal of volatility. Volatility kills company planning. It kills the economics for individual companies. Chemical industry. There are no new chemical plants being built in this country. They're all going overseas because natural gas, as you know, is more of a domestic market. Oil is a global market. Natural gas is more expensive in this country than other countries. Chemical companies are leaving. Automakers, huge energy users, they also have to take the hit on the new technologies. It's just going to be an impact we see as these automakers struggle to adjust and to meet the high oil prices. Appliance makers are going to have to adjust. Airlines are going to struggle mightily because they can just charge more for the energy prices, right? Well, guess what? We're just not going to fly as much because we're going to have less money of our own anyway. So airlines will probably take a hit. I think we'll probably see, this isn't necessarily a bad thing, I think you'll probably see a move to diesel. Renewables and alternatives. One of the impacts that we see is positive. I talked to a lot of you probably think, oh good, high oil prices, people are going to take me seriously in what I do. Well, that's true. And that's going to be one of the positive impacts. I'm going to talk about a couple solutions, and I'm going to take a minute to talk about a solution that relates with oil. And I know that you guys aren't in the business of oil, but I know that you need to know what's going on in that arena. I'm going to try to be smart and turn this off before I get a phone call. First of all, we've had a high amount of people refinancing their homes. The other thing that has been saving our hinies this whole time, and we don't even know it, most of us, is that we have had a gigantic increase of oil imports from Canada. If you stack up a graph of all the biggest oil reserves in the world, Saudi Arabia's first, then you have Iran and United Arab Emirates, you have Kuwait, you have Nigeria and Mexico, Venezuela, and probably where that speaker is over there, you would have had Canada 10 years ago. Well, in about a 5-year period, Canada went from being not on the map, literally. Guess where they are now? They are second to Saudi Arabia in oil reserves. And they are pumping out 1 million barrels a day to the U.S. 1/4 of all the oil that our country imports now is coming from Canada, and it's a brand new phenomenon. And most people don't realize it, but that has given us a small benefit during this period of high prices. It would have been much worse during these things could have had a much bigger impact on us if we didn't have a big, friendly, attached neighbor pumping oil down to us as fast as they can make it. And that oil is coming from an unconventional resource called oil sands. Oil sands is a very heavy oil mixed with sand. It takes a little work. There's a lot of people who say it's not an energy balance, but they actually, for every unit of energy they put in, they get 8 units of energy back out. It's a good process that works. They are effective at getting oil from oil sands at $30 a barrel, and they're only increasing. So there's one of the solutions, is that Canada is now rising to the top in oil production, well, at least in oil reserves, and their oil production, their annual production, is actually catching up fairly nicely. There's a nice, friendly, stable neighbor. Remember, clean cities cannot meet this gap, so we need that solution as well. Another solution is that in the United States, we have oil shale and tar sands. Let me give you an example of how much oil shale and tar sands mean to us. I've talked to a number of geologists, a number of energy experts, and they all basically agree with this number, even though they might change it slightly. Well, let me first give you a number. The world reserves of oil are 1.6 trillion barrels. 1.6 trillion in the entire world. That's OPEC, the U.S., Mexico, 1.6 trillion. In just the U.S., oil, shale, and tar sands that we're not developing, but that we, most people say we could develop, the experts say there is somewhere between 1 and 2 trillion barrels of oil. And it's in a very small area in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming, just those three corners where they meet. They have as much as the entire world reserves in oil that's recoverable. Not just theoretically, but recoverable. A lot of that's oil sands, which is already being recovered in Canada, and oil shale. And it's, some people say, well, it's never been done, it can't be done, it's always the good potential. Well, I can tell you that we are beyond just potential. We are already now getting oil out of shale, we're getting oil out of our tar sands, and it's just a matter of turning it into demonstration projects and commercial projects, and we'll get there. So one of the solutions to this problem and this problem is going to be the fact that a teeter-totter, as Saudi Arabia and OPEC, as their oil continues to get sourer every year, and as their reserves go down, they're dwindling as a global leader, somebody who can control the price band, and there's no longer a price band. And North America will rise up, and Canada's already leading the way. It's nobody can argue with Canada's numbers. It's already happening there. And the U.S. will probably catch up, too, and create a bit of a teeter-totter as the Middle East and as some of the scariest areas in the world go down. Some very peaceful nations, some nations very close to us, are going to rise up and meet that need. That can't happen fast enough for this either. And that's why my boss has been very focused on all the alternatives, and he's pushed them very, very hard. The Energy Policy Act was signed into law in August. Initially, I was going to talk a lot about that, a lot of the details, but so many of your workshops and things are getting into the nuts and bolts of that I don't want to do that today. I want to keep it broad on the big picture so you know what's happening in the world. But let's talk a little bit about it. In there is everything that you're working on. Everything for electrons, everything for oil, everything for alternatives for transportation fuels, wind, geothermal, all these things are all in there. These are things specifically that Senator Hatch has worked on, and they hit some of the major points. First of all, he promotes oil, shale, and tar sand development in this country. Second of all, he promotes more natural gas development. We have not given any new leases for oil, for natural gas development in the West, even though there is a huge resource of natural gas that's untapped. We have done new permits for drilling on existing leases, and so people think, oh, there's this huge increase. What there is not an increase in is new leases, new resources given to companies so that they can go after them. And there are resources available. Senator Hatch has done a little work in that area. The part in the, you've heard about refineries, are that we sort of have this bottleneck at refineries. We're now importing 10% of our processed petroleum. A lot of people think that's a big problem. Senator Hatch does as well. The piece in the energy bill that's on refineries is actually Senator Hatch's as well. Senator Hatch introduced a bill to promote geothermal and other renewables. The tax structure right now works against them because there's a little bit of an incentive that dies before they can ever actually build a plant. So Senator Hatch's legislation attempts to expand the production tax credit so that we can produce those kind of clean electrons, specifically on geothermal. Very, very much an untapped source of electrons in this country. The CLEAR Act. You've already heard a little bit about the CLEAR Act. Some of you have probably heard a lot about the CLEAR Act if you've ever heard me speak. I'm a little afraid to talk too much about it, but it's so relevant. I think I have to hit the main points. It was about 6 years ago, Senator Hatch got together with some Democratic colleagues, and he pulled together environmentalists, and he pulled together auto industry folks, and he tried to get them in a room to actually come out with a product that they could both agree on, a legislative product. to promote alternative fuel vehicles and advanced car technologies. The CLEAR Act stands for Clean, Efficient Automobiles Resulting from Advanced Car Technologies. I'm very proud of that. It's a three-legged stool, and Senator Hatch has fought desperately to keep the three legs of that stool in place. One is it promotes through tax incentives infrastructure. And this is alternative fueling infrastructure. If you're a retail gas station and you want to put in a natural gas pump or an ethanol pump or E80, you know, whatever, as long as it's a fuel such as E85, then you would get a couple of tax benefits for that. One for getting the equipment, for purchasing it, the other for installing it. Secondly, there's an incentive. Hey, Paul, how's it going? Paul's with the Natural Gas Vehicle Coalition. It took us a lot of work, with a lot of Paul's help, to make sure that we kept our incentive to promote the fuels themselves. We didn't want to give an incentive to produce a fuel. We wanted to give an incentive for fuel going into a tank. And so at the retail sale of fuel, as it goes into a vehicle, we provided a strong tax credit at that point. And thirdly, there's vehicle credits. Credits for dedicated alternative fuel vehicles. And from a policy perspective, these vehicles need to be dedicated. It can't be a flex fuel vehicle, because if we're going to give you cash for buying that vehicle, we want to know that that vehicle is going to be displacing conventional oil for the life of that vehicle, and that makes the credit worth it for the government. Also, for advanced car technologies, for hybrids, battery electrics, those types of things, the credit that you get now for the Priuses and the Camrys and the Escapes, those are the CLEAR Act credits. Took a lot of work to get it done. When we began this effort, President Bush had just been elected. President Bush was talking about a new energy task force. Our coalition of automakers, alternative gas companies, and environmentalists and automakers and bipartisan staff were the first people knocking on the door when the Energy Task Force was established, saying, you need to make this part of our nation's energy strategy. And we have been a part of every energy bill that has been considered ever since. And we're really very proud that as we finally passed an energy bill 6 years later, the CLEAR Act's on there. A couple of things, a little disappointing with the energy bill. I mentioned a few things that Senator Hatch did. Because of costs, because our government always has scarce resources, Senator Hatch's refinery bill had to get cut back, where they only gave us about half of what we were asking for. And then Senator Hatch's geothermal bill got cut back because of limited resources. And then the CLEAR Act itself got cut back. We were able to keep all three legs of the stool, but they put a cap on top of how many hybrid credits. Am I running out of time? I'm running out of time. So I'll just end with one last point. So they put a cap on how many each hybrid set can get a credit. So we were disappointed in that, but we were able to do it. Now we see with prices getting back up to $70 a barrel, sort of an oil rush. And this oil rush is politicians running to gas companies to stand in front of their gas station signs and come up with new solutions to our energy crisis. And even the Republicans, they invited us about a half an hour. There's a group of Republicans that stood up and had a new proposal. And three parts of their proposal was to put all the stuff they took away from us on geothermal, put in all the stuff they took away from us on refineries, and to lift the cap on the hybrids and put back some of the stuff they took away in the CLEAR Act. And it was a little disappointing to us that, you know, first of all, they took it away and then gave it up. It reminds me of something that happened to a neighbor of mine where his wife was getting out of the shower as he was getting in the shower. And so his wife put on her towel and ran out. And just as he was getting in the shower, the doorbell rang. And she ran down and answered the door. It was another neighbor that I know. And he was there, and he said, oh, hello. And she goes, oh, sorry, my husband's up in the shower. And he goes, well, you know, I don't want to be rude, but you look pretty attractive in that towel there. She goes, oh, well, thanks. And he says, I don't want to be rude, but I'd give you $800 for a quick peek. And she was incensed. She was very mad, but she also wanted that $800. So she gave him a quick peek, and he handed her the $800, and they both walked away pretty happy. She runs back up to the bathroom to finish her makeup and things. And from the shower, her husband yells out, "Hey, who's at the door?" And she goes, "Oh, it's Harry next door." And he goes, "Oh, good. Did he say anything about the $800 he owes us?" Well, that's how we felt during that press conference, where they took everything away from us and then were giving it back to us and taking credit for giving it back. Anyway, I can take some questions and answers. I might have taken a little bit too much time, but there are microphones. Oh, we're not going to have questions and answers, but I'll be around for a little while, and I appreciate talking to you, and I hope you have a great conference. Thanks.
No question and answer.